every warrior through. In one great show of strength, he lifted the warrior up and over his head, throwing him like a cut of meat onto an open fire, and then he waded deeper into battle, eyes filled with glee, laughing all the while. Hadad was nearby, stout Zakhar by her side.
"We must retreat," Emre said.
Hadad said nothing. She couldn't take her eyes from the worm, which moved closer with every rolling beat of its great wings. Emre took her arm and shook her.
"By the gods, help me! Those who remain will die or be enslaved by Onur, including you and your crew."
She nodded numbly, as if her mind were only now lifting from the ruin Onur had made of her plans when he bashed Mihir's head in.
"Come,"
she snapped at her bodyguard, Zakhar. Together, the three of them stood before a second wave of Kadri warriors running from the ships, hands high, gesturing wildly.
"The tribe!"
Emre called, looking up to the worm.
"We must save those we can!"
Many paid him no heed, but a few, and then more, paused, paralyzed with fear as the worm reached an apex and dropped into a dive. Its wings pulled tight to its body as it speared toward the nearest of the Kadri ships. When it came close, it curled its body in, legs forward, wings snapping outward, while its tail twisted sharply to adjust the angle of its landing. It crashed between the ship's masts, snapping rigging as it fell upon the crew. Its tail lashed as its jaws came in reach of any man or woman who hoped to stand against it. The ship's crew had spears, swords and bows, but they didn't stand a chance. Its jaws snapped at bodies, crushing them before throwing them wide. Its claws rent flesh and bone and wood alike. From the aft of the ship, it slipped down to the sand, tail whipping behind, delivering terrible cuts from the sharp spines, only to climb back on the foredeck and begin its assault anew. More of Onur's soldiers approached the battle. Many swung their swords over their heads, rejoicing at this demonstration of Onur's power.
"Now!"
Emre commanded Mihir's tribe.
"We go now!"
"With me," Hadad said, motioning to her ship. "Convince as many as you can to follow."
"I'll fight with you," Emre told the dozen nearest him. "The rest will get the ships moving. We retreat only when they're on the move."
As Hadad led most of them toward the ships, Emre ran with those he had chosen, his heart pounding with fear as they joined the battle. Shouts of anguish and moaning mingled with cries of rage and desperation. The sound of steel on steel was all around him, as was the crack of wooden shields being struck or sundered. The roars of the worm felt as though they were coming from just behind him. Several times he looked over his shoulder and saw that it had laid the first ship to waste and had fallen upon a second. He nearly lost his head as a Masal warrior attacked him with a feverish energy. Emre was no master swordsman like Masid, but he held the warrior off, retreating while shouting for those nearest to prepare to retreat. Thankfully, several of the Kadri ships were beginning to glide over the sand. A horn blew, signalling the warriors that the fleet was nearly ready. No sooner had it sounded, though, then the worm landed on that very ship. The woman blowing the horn was lost and the sound cut short as the worm's jaws clamped over her. It lifted her up, thrusting its neck like a stork swallowing a fish, devouring her whole. More ships began to move.
"Now!"
Emre cried.
"Retreat!"
But Onur's warriors had started to surround them. They curled around their flanks like a crescent moon. There was now only a narrow gap through which to retreat, a gap that was quickly closing.
Onur,
Emre realized. Onur was still nearby. If he could wound the king,
It would distract his warriors and give Tribe Kadri the diversion they needed.
Emre released a primal scream, putting all of himself into wild swings against the two men before him, preparing to push through a gap and charge for Anor when a stout figure began wading through the battle. It was Zakhar, Hadad's bodyguard. He had the same scowl he always wore. The warriors before him were unable to stand against his powerful strides. He moved across fallen bodies, through men and women locked in battle, heedless of everything and everyone but Anor. He wielded his massive scimitar to devastating effect. But he took cut after cut from swords all around him. One bit into his shoulder, another sunk deep into the top of his bald head. But strangely, the cuts didn't bleed, nor did they go as far as they ought. It was as if Zakhar were made of earth and stone, not skin and bone. A shout alerted Anor to Zakhar's advance. He turned just in time to meet a downward chop from Zakhar's scimitar. Anor blocked it to the side, then did so a second time. On the third swing, he blocked it wide and struck Zakhar across the jaw with the butt of his spear. It struck with such force that Zakhar's entire jaw flew wide from his face and spun over the heads of the nearby warriors. Even Anor stared in horror at the place Zakhar's jaw had once been. What remained was a misshapen gap made of what looked to be red clay. A golem. Emre understood suddenly, just as the stories of Malasan told. Zakhar hardly seemed to care. He drove his sword so hard against Anor's side that even though Anor blocked it, he was thrown backward several steps. All those around Anor converged on Zakhar, but Zakhar's dead eyes were fixed on Anor alone.
Tribe Kadri!
Emre called, knowing they would never have a better chance.
We go now that we may fight another day!
En masse, the Kadri warriors roared and delivered a flurry of blows before disengaging. They ran, but Anor's soldiers were ready. Emre was nearly cut down from behind, but an old man with a long white beard threw himself at the Salmuk warriors chasing him. He fought bravely, but was cut down a moment later. Emre and the others flocked toward the ships. Their sails were raised, billowing as they gathered the hot desert winds. Emre made for Hadad's ship, his throat and lungs burning. The muscles of his legs nearly gave out, but he managed to gain the ship with Hadad's help as a rain of arrows began to fall, biting into the hull and deck of the dhow. As the crews answered with their own rain of arrows, Emre helped Moore up to the deck. One slipped, her eyes wide when an arrow struck the meat of her calf. Emre held on and managed to hold her tight to the ship. One of Hadad's crew dropped to the deck by his side, grabbed a fistful of her thorb and hauled her up, the woman screaming the whole while. Behind the ship, the worm lifted into the sky. It circled once, twice, then dove straight for Hadad's ship. A crewman was at the rear ballista, a heavy bolt in the channel, ready to fly, but just as he was aiming it, an arrow took him in the neck. Blood spurted as he grabbed for it. He jerked on the arrow shaft reflexively and actually managed to pull it free, but the moment he did, a spray of crimson flew from the wound, staining the ballista, the bulwarks and the deck beneath him. An indescribable terror frothed up inside Emre, threatening to overwhelm him, but he quashed it while dashing for the ballista, knowing he only had moments before it was on them. The worm swooped low and began its strange, undulating flight toward Emre's ship. Its shadow swept across the ground below, a dark companion as the worm's shape loomed ever larger. When Emre reached the ballista, every fiber of his being urged him to squeeze the lever that would release the bolt,
but he couldn't risk a miss.
The worm came closer and closer. It dipped and pulled sharply up and stretched its clawed feet forward and opened its great maw to reveal razor teeth and a barbed tongue.
Emery squeezed the lever. The bolt flew with a great thud.
The worm's neck came forward and a black cloud issued from its mouth, which flew toward the ship in one great stream. As if the worm hoped to spray the entire ship, stem to stern, from the top of the mainmast down to the decks. But then the bolt pierced the worm's wing, just above its right shoulder, puncturing the skin. Immediately it curled to the right, the inky cloud trailing off along with it.
"Take cover!"
Emery shouted, and ducked under the ballista. Where the black spray had struck, it ate through the sails. It burned the wood. The crew screamed in pain, and then it hit Emery too. Black droplets burned through his shirt and along his shoulders and back. Wherever it touched, his skin sizzled and bubbled. Emery found himself sucking air through gritted teeth. He tore off his shirt and used it to wipe himself wherever he could reach. It may have helped, but did nothing to ease the pain, which grew worse until he was crying out with the rest of the crew. The mizzen sail was eaten through so badly it looked as though it had lain moth-eaten for 100 years. The remnants at the head flapped in the wind. The mainmast was better, but was beginning to tear from the sizable holes near the top. The foresails, thank the gods, were largely intact. Looking back, Emery saw that perhaps 2 dozen ships had managed to sail away. Another 20 were still at the site of the battle. The victors, Honor's warriors, raised their swords to the sky and gave ululating calls. The worm, praise be to Baki for his kindness, had dropped to the ground and was nursing the hole in its wing. Its tongue lapped at the blood running along its skin. As their forms dwindled into the distance, Emre's relief became anger. Baki may have shown them some small kindness, but the gods had given Honor more than he already had. Long life, terrible strength and speed, and now a bloody great worm. How can we fight him when the gods are his allies? With no answers likely to arrive soon, Emery turned away and went to help the wounded. Chapter 45. Deep beneath Sukru's palace, Isan walked down a darkened passageway. The jailer accompanied him, holding a lantern to light their way, though the combination of his noticeable limp and unsteady hand made the light swing so wildly it made Isan sick.
"If you please," Isan said, holding his hand out for the lantern. "It's enough to make a mule vomit."
The man handed it over, but not without a sullen look.
"Hello!"
came a booming voice from the passageway ahead.
"Can you hear me? Tell the King of Kings I would speak with him alone."
It was Zeheb's voice. Isan never thought he'd see the day. He sounded completely terrified.
"I will speak with Kiral. I am King Zeheb, and I will speak with Kiral."
"Enough, you bloody crow," the jailer groused. "Do that again, and you'll get dog bones and peace water for a week."
To Isan's utter astonishment, Zeheb fell silent.
"You do know you're speaking to a king, don't you?" Isan asked the jailer.
The jailer's sullen look turned darker.
"I know my lord Sukru gave a prisoner over to me, and that he's as loud as the end of days. Still," Isan said, allowing a touch of power to leach into his voice, "you'll not speak ill of him again."
The jailer said nothing, but his face was now crunched up so badly he looked like a prune. They reached a door shortly after, and the jailer used his jingle of keys to open the door.
Zaheb's voice called tentatively from the darkness.
Kiral?
No, Isan said.
Not Kiral.
There was no reply as he stepped inside and held his hand out to the jailer.
The keys.
The jailer's mismatched eyes stared at the keys for a moment, then at the open doorway.
Now, Isan said.
Of course, my lord king,
he said contritely as he handed the keys over.
Now wait for me above.
And off he bobbed into the darkness, leaving Isan alone with the King of Whispers. When he was sure the man was far enough that he wouldn't hear the conversation, Isan entered the cell. He held the lantern in his left hand, his triple-bladed knife in his right. The cell was large, meant for several at once, which was perhaps why Zaheb looked so small, huddled in one corner as he was.
Are you well?
Isan asked easily.
Have you been fed? Would you like water?
Zaheb gaped in pure befuddlement.
Isan, there's been a terrible mistake.
Undoubtedly, but it will be corrected soon enough.
Zaheb shook his head as if Isan hadn't just threatened him.
Can you call for Kiral? I didn't know what I was saying, but I'm better now. I can explain everything.
That won't be necessary.
I'm so confused, Isan. I didn't do those things. You did.
Yes, of course.
Isan didn't bother telling him about the tincture that had been slipped into his wine during Davood's interrogation of Cheda. What would be the point other than to gloat? The drug was a Kunduni import and very rare. Its original name was difficult to translate, but meant, more or less, wanderlust. And in this case, was the perfect solution. It caused confusion for a time, and often docility. Like this, the victim was unable to piece together his thoughts, unable to recall his memories. Under the right circumstances, it could make a man seem as if he were hiding things. Which was exactly how Zaheb had seemed and exactly what Isan had wanted. It also made him suggestible. The drug was wearing off, but there was still enough running through Zaheb's veins that he wouldn't be able to resist Isan's voice or deny him answers.
Have you been listening to Kiral? Isan asked, allowing power to flow through his words.
Zaheb shook his head.
I would never.
I need the truth, Zaheb, or I'll never be able to help you.
I haven't. The chances of him sensing it were too great.
Have you been taken beneath his wing, then? Are you his man?
Zaheb swallowed hard.
Yes.
Interesting.
When? Not long before you came to my palace.
When you had me attacked.
It took Zaheb some time to nod.
Yes.
Isan nodded. He suspected as much.
And yet, if you're half the man I remember, you would still keep an eye on him.
Zaheb had always been good at hiding his emotions, but affected by the drug, his old instincts were apparently lost to him. It was almost comical seeing how transparently guilty the man looked.
I've listened to some whispers, but not Kiral's. I swear it, only those around him.
And what did they say?
Kiral and Hamzakir are in league. They've made arrangements for the burgeoning 13th tribe to be destroyed.
Isan started piecing the puzzle together.
They're going to help Onor.
Zaheb nodded.
At least in so much as they can quell the knowledge of the tribe before it threatens the natural order of things.
Isan nearly laughed.
Natural order. The natural order would have seen us dead 4 centuries ago.
And I suppose Hamzakir, if this is successful, will suddenly find himself
with a seat at Sharakai's table. When the lantern's light guttered for a moment, Zaheb stared at it, his brows pinching, as if within that lonely glow he had found some small amount of hope.
Yes.
And who suggested this arrangement?
Khamzakir.
This time Isan did laugh.
Now let me guess the price for this bargain. Half of our elixirs of long life. The very elixirs that Khamzakir managed to steal from your palace.
Zaheb's eyes widened like a little boy who'd just been shown his first magic trick.
Just so.
In the end, the arrangement wasn't surprising, but it did make Isan wonder just how far Kiral planned to take this. How much of Sharakai was he willing to surrender to Khamzakir, and conversely, how much was Khamzakir willing to settle for?
Who else knows?
Zaheb was quivering. He was trying to resist, and Isan could tell it was becoming easier for him. There was little time left then.
Who else knows of the bargain, Zaheb? Sukru and Kahil. What of Husamatin and Bashir? I've heard no whispers of import coming from their halls.
It made sense. Both Husamatin and Bashir would likely balk at such an arrangement.
Very well, Isan said.
When he stood, taking up the lantern, Zaheb looked relieved.
We were allies once, Isan. Will you speak with Kiral? Convince him that this has all been a mistake?
No.
But I do have one last request of you, after which you will be free to do as you will.
He paused.
Are you ready? I am. I'll do anything.
Isan smiled widely.
I don't blame you for threatening Nayan. I was angry over it, but I can understand why you would do it. But you should never have threatened my unborn child. I know.
In the span of a heartbeat, much of the hope in Zaheb's eyes vanished.
I swear to you, I'll never do so again.
You're right, because what I want you to do, Zaheb, is listen to the whispers.
Zaheb's face brightened.
Of course. Which ones?
Never before had Isan put so much of himself into his power.
All of them.
Zaheb couldn't disobey. Not this. His chin quivered. The worry in his eyes intensified, even as they lost their focus. He was now staring through Isan, as if he could see the whole of the desert. His breath came faster, his hands pressed flat against the stone beneath him. His jowls shook. The long moan that escaped him reminded Isan of a wounded black laughter he'd seen on a hunt once. As the hunters had closed in, long, wheezing breaths had overcome it. It had tried to struggle, tried to fight to no effect in the end. Zaheb was that doomed beast, a man who recognized his fate as more and more of the whispers came to him. From this palace, from the House of Kings, from the city beyond, soon they would reach even to the desert, for his ability to control it, his desire to control it, had been stolen from him with Isan's command. Isan left the cell and calmly locked the door behind him. The first of Zaheb's screams chased him down the dark hallway. By the time Isan had reached the jailer's room, they'd become so maniacal there was hardly a pause for breath from one to the next. Isan handed the jailer the keys.
You'll forget that I was here, and you'll ignore the king's screaming. When he falls silent, you'll inspect his cell and then tell King Sukru what you found.
Of course, my lord king.
Isan took the stairs, wondering how long it would be before Zaheb drove himself perfectly utterly mad.
Chapter 46. Chada was chained to the bed of an enclosed wagon. Sunlight slanted in through the lone, barred window at the rear, sometimes playing against the wagon's dark interior, at other times lost as they navigated the many switchbacks along King's Road. It was the end of a miserably hot day. Sweat trickled along her skin, made her scalp itch. The cramped space inside the wagon was hot as a bloody oven. After nearly an hour of waiting, the wagon began to move. It rocked, creaked and leaned awkwardly as it navigated the stones and potholes of King's Road. The rattle of the wheels mixed with the jingle of tack and the clop of hooves. The distant sound of temple bells honoured the setting sun. It made her wonder if Davood, wherever he was now, could hear them too. She was still so shaken by the look on his face, his intensity as he sought to kill her. She had seen that look before, but only on men like Hamid, cold-blooded killers. Davood, a peaceful dove above all else, was anything but. So why had he done it? She had been able to come up with only one answer. Isan. Why else would Davood have done such a thing? She supposed it was possible Sukru had threatened him, but the way Sukru had stared so hawkishly at every move Davood made, as if in awe of Davood's powers, made her think it wasn't so. Isan had been a different story. He had seemed intrigued, then surprised, then shocked at all the right moments. A good performance, but Chada felt certain it had been just that. A performance. When Davood had shared Onur's bloody verse, she'd thought Isan might have been subtly nodding to her about the pact they'd made on Toriat, that he would reveal the name of her father if she brought him Onur's head. But she realized what a mistake that had been. After her capture, Isan had likely seen how ill-advised their compact had been and decided to tie off that thread before it unraveled all his careful planning. He'd only given Davood Onur's bloody verse because Onur was now an enemy. It would prove Davood a trustworthy source, and if it also reminded the kings that Onur was still a threat to them, so much the better. It struck her how brilliantly Isan had orchestrated Saheb's implication. He must have pulled dozens of strings just so, including the ones that tied him to Saheb. When he had been accused, the King of Whispers had sat there, dumbfounded as if waking from a dream. Had Isan whispered in his ear as well? After Davood's peculiar escape from the palace, the kings had come to inspect the damage. They had questioned Sumeya and Xander, allowing only a cursory explanation. Husamatin had halted the interrogation and ordered Sumeya to return Chada to his palace.
"She's in my care," Sukru had spat,
with King Cahil standing just beyond him.
"She is now mine to question."
Husamatin had stared at him with a look of such intensity Chada thought he might draw his sword and cleave Sukru in two, but he had merely kept his eyes fixed on Sukru and repeated his order for Sumeya to lead Chada away, which he had done a moment later. Melisse, Camille, and Indris had accompanied them to the palace, where the wagon and horses had been waiting for them. It was strange that Sumeya had ordered the driver down from the bench and taken the reins herself.
Gods, what happens now?
Perhaps Husamatin would give her over to the dark Asir again. Perhaps he'd threaten Sahid Alaz's life unless he got his answers. Perhaps she'd have her day on the gallows after all. After a time, Sumeya called,
"Whoa! Whoa!"
and the wagon creaked to a halt. The clopping of the horses behind the wagon, the ones carrying Camille, Indris, and Melisse, came to a halt as well.
"Camille and Indris,"
Sumeya's voice called from the driver's bench.
Continue on to the House of the Maidens. Inform the matrons we'll return when we're able. Don't you think it best that we all accompany you to the palace?
Indris's voice grating and impertinent.
Do as I've ordered, maiden,
Sumeya replied easily.
Go, and we'll speak in the morning.
Come, girl,
Camille said. The first warden has spoken.
One of the horses exhaled noisily.
Call me girl again,
hooves thudded against packed earth,
and we'll have more than words.
Chayda heard a snort from Camille. She could picture her sneer, a thing she'd seen a thousand times while practicing their swordcraft. Soon two horses were trotting away. When the sound of their retreat had dwindled, the wagon lurched back into motion, heading downhill for a time, then uphill, surely along the spur of King's Road that led to Husamitin's palace. It was a goodly distance away, and yet a short while later, the wagon came to a halt. Chayda thought they were waiting for other horses to pass, perhaps another wagon. But she heard nothing save the lonely call of an amberlark.
I have to piss, Chayda said, as the silence continued to lengthen. I'd rather do it in the bushes than in the back of a wagon.
The window at the front of the wagon snapped open, and Sumeya's face appeared there.
If ever there was a time for silence, Chedamine, it is now.
She slid the door shut with a loud clack. Chayda was tempted to goad her again, but there was something in the way she'd spoken, as if she were on the cusp of changing her mind about something. Through the window at the rear, Chayda saw sunlight fade. Stars began to glint through an apricot sky, and the heat in the wagon, thank the gods, began to abate.
She should be here by now, Chayda heard Melisse whisper. There's time yet. I'm still not sure this is wise, Melisse said, her voice soft but urgent.
Sumeya's reply was calm reassurance.
We no longer have a choice.
A choice in what? Chayda thought. Killing me. But if that were so, why wait? Why not slit her throat and be done with it? There she is, Sumeya said a short while later.
Soon Chayda heard a lone horse coming toward them. The wagon rocked. A sharp crunch of stones followed. Sumeya leaping down from the driver's bench. Soon there came the clank of the bar at the back of the wagon being lifted. The hinges groaned as the door swung wide. Sumeya was there, Melisse behind her, and beyond them, a matron rode toward them. Her identity was obscured by the darkness, but Chayda quickly recognized her.
By the gods! Zaid!
As Zaid pulled up, Sumeya met her and held the reins of her horse. Chayda realized she'd been wrong about their location on Toriat. They weren't along the road to Husamitin's palace, but in a small vale lower down the mountain. It was used as a festival grounds to honor the rites of spring and autumn. More importantly, it was largely hidden from view.
Is it all prepared?
Sumeya asked.
Yes,
Zaid replied, who untied a sack from her saddle. Zaid may have seen the better part of 70 summers, but she carried herself like a woman decades younger.
Have you told her?
No,
Sumeya said, turning back to Chayda. Zaid, holding the small sack, approached. Melisse flanked her. All three stared soberly at Chayda.
What's happening? Chayda asked.
Sumeya took a deep breath before speaking again.
When we found you in the desert, you shared the tale of Anasir with Melisse. No, what I shared was a story concocted by Husamitin. There was no truth in it.
Sumeya tilted her head noncommittally.
That has yet to be determined.
Chayda waved to the wagon, to the veil around them.
Then why all this?
Because I will have my own answers, not those of my father, nor those of his brother kings.
Chada thought back to her dungeon cell, the sounds of footsteps coming from the darkened hall.
That was you in Husamatine's dungeon.
Sumer's silence was answer enough.
You know Sahid Alaz is there then. You know the truth.
Sahid Alaz is there,
Sumer replied, but I learn nothing from him. The chains my father placed on him have robbed him of his ability to bond, or even speak.
Then we must go to him. I'll show you what he said is true.
Sumer shook her head. The paths to his cell are guarded too closely.
Then what do you propose?
Zaid pulled a black maiden's dress from the bag.
We go to the blooming fields. And you will prove your story, free of any influence from the kings.
Chayda stared at the three of them. Zaid already knew the truth, of course. It was Sumeya and Melisse who had to be convinced.
If you were fooled once, she said to them both, what difference will it make now? I could manufacture a story as your father did.
What Husamatine did felt true at the time, Melisse said. But in the days that followed it felt hollow, a play performed for our benefit.
Now that we know the signs of the Asirim being manipulated,
Sumer echoed, we'll sense if you're lying or if another is affecting them unduly.
And if we go, Chayda said, if I show you the truth, what then? You risk your lives. At best you'll be expelled from the House of Maidens. At worst, you'll be tortured and hung as traitors.
Sumer's look of regret made it clear she was not at all sure she had made the right decision.
You'd rather I return you to your cell.
I have no way of knowing what you'll do when you learn the truth. For all I know, this is a way for the kings to learn more about the Asirim or the 13th tribe.
For the first time, Sumer's veneer cracked. The first warden of the Blade Maidens was just a woman, with the weight of the desert on her shoulders.
I was born to the House of Kings. I was raised to become a Blade Maiden. It is a role I have relished from the moment I took my ebon blade from my father's hands. I revere all that we have fought for it is our strength that protects Sharakai from our enemies. No matter what we find in the memories of the Asirim, what the maidens have done is not nothing. Sharakai would have fallen long ago had we not been there to protect her. Yet still, I would not have the House of Maidens built on a foundation of lies. The truth may shatter all I've known, but I would still learn it. For only in truth can justice be served.
In Sumer's bright brown eyes, there was a bit of the forlornness she'd shown on their journey to Ishmantep and back. It was a look that spoke of love. It made Chayda uncomfortable, not because she didn't share some of those same feelings, but because she was aware of the influence it might have had in delivering Sumer here. But there was so much more to this than love, and Chayda took measure of it. She weighed Sumer's words, her sincerity, her resolve, and found that she believed her. Sumer would do as she had promised and grant Chayda a chance to prove herself, and that, Chayda decided, was all she could ask. As she reached for the maiden's dress in Zaid's arms, Sumer seized Chayda's wrist.
And if I was wrong to trust you?
Sumer's look had hardened. She was first warden once more.
If I find you're lying, then I'll confess my sins and deliver my sword to my father. But only after I've used it to take your head from your shoulders. Zaid as well. Your blood will feed the twisted trees and the sand will swallow your bones.
Chayda nodded and Sumer released her. As Chayda accepted the dress from Zaid, the two of them shared a look. Zaid had much to answer for, foremost among them the death of Amalos,
the master at the collegium who had mentored Davood. But now was not the time. Zayd had done much in bringing Melis and Sumeyya to this moment. After giving Chayda a chance to don her dress, they were off, riding down King's Road, three maidens and a matron, all of them veiled. They came to level ground and headed west toward the House of Maidens. As they rode through, they went unchallenged, both as they entered the inner gates, as they rode out and into the city. Those on guard, Chayda was sure, had been hand-picked by Sumeyya. When they came to the wheel, they turned north and rode hard to the northern harbour, then headed down one of the ramps that led to the sand. Four silver spears forced them to a halt at the chains across the mouth of the harbour. When Sumeyya ordered them to lower the barricade, they quickly complied, and the four of them were off again. As the lights of the city began to dim, Chayda kept glancing over her shoulder, listening for the sounds of alarm from the harbour or from the palaces on their dark hill. She could see them on Toriat, huddling like a murder of magpies, a thousand eyes aflame. But no alarm was raised, no one gave chase, and soon they were into the desert proper. They reached the blooming fields just as Rhea was rising in the east. They dropped from their horses and walked into one of the groves. The trees were silent around them, their blooms closed. Under Rhea's light they looked as if they had been dipped in gold, preserved until the end of days. "Here," Chayda said. They knelt in a circle on sand-swept stone. Chayda across from Zayd, Sumeyya across from Melis. They clasped hands, and their breathing fell into sync with one another. When Chayda had calmed herself, she reached out for the Aesir. They were deep in their slumber. Deeper, in fact, than at any time Chayda could remember. There had always been some like this in the blooming fields. The weak, the wounded, those who had recently feasted on the blood of the living, but their numbers had always been few. This night, all of them were so. Husamatin's doing? Chayda knew. It was a fear that had been building since leaving Sharakai. Husamatin would likely sense her presence when she tried to waken them. He may even work to hide the truth, as he had before, but she couldn't allow it. Not this time. She would need to be ready to work against him. "Wake, my brothers and sisters. Wake, for I would listen to your tales." Some few stirred at her call, yet they remained hidden, their minds cloaked. She tried harder, and yet they remained as they were, minds dulled, their bodies inert. "Calm yourself," Sumeyya said. Chayda realized she had lost her balance. She took a deep breath, felt the circle of their clasped hands, and tried again. Merely bonding with the Aesirim was a crude act, akin to chaining an unruly hound. The ability to commune with them, as she was attempting now, was something else entirely. She was sure it was tied to her heritage as a child of the 13th tribe. That, in turn, made her wonder about Husamatin. Did he have blood of the 13th tribe running through his veins? Had his mother or father or a more distant ancestor been born in the tents of Sahid Alaz's people? Perhaps. Perhaps it had been true of Misut as well. Was that why these two kings were stronger with the Aesirim? She refused to believe it was merely the gods granting them power. If so, all the kings would be equally strong. She felt Melis stir by her side. She felt Zayd's waning hope, Sumeyya's rising disappointment. She might have been rattled once, but there was something about being here with these women, women she did not fully trust, nor who fully trusted her, but who had given her a chance. She spread her awareness farther, became attuned to those beneath the sands. She felt the wound
on the meat of her thumb flare, and for once did nothing to either quell the pain or intensify it. She merely felt the familiar ache, felt it spread along her hand, her fingers, her wrist, and up her tattooed arm. It made her aware of the Adhikara as much as the Asuram, which felt truer, somehow, more complete.
"Come now," she called to the Asuram. "It's time that your voices were heard." Her voice seemed to stir the Asuram. She felt their dreams turn toward her.
One, only a short distance away, began clawing at the sand. It squirmed and rose up from the roots of the Adhikara like a rattlewing from its chrysalis. A fleshy frame was limed in gold moonlight, lanky hair, sagging breasts, a woman once. Wounds were visible, a gash along her ribs, more on her shoulders and arms, all half-healed, suppurating, revealing rotted flesh. The Adhikara made a path for her. The limbs of the twisted trees cracked like the joints of the aged, as if they could not suffer the Aesir's touch. Once free, the Aesir stood at odd angles, an ungainly doll propped up by children's hands. She stared at Cheda, intense, her eyes bits of broken diamonds.
"What is your name?" Cheda asked.
The Aesir's breath rattled in her throat. She flexed her fingers, worked her lower jaw, which seemed askew as if broken. More dark forms rose up behind her. 2, then 5, then 10, then 20. Cheda understood with sudden and fierce clarity that they followed the first, their unlikely matriarch. Cheda knew they retained some sense of who they'd been before Bet Iman, that they still deferred to their king, Sahid Alaz. She even knew they hoped that he might one day save them. She had had no idea that they still retained any sense of tribe beyond that. Yet here were dozens who deferred to another, a dark queen, while their king was missing. Their sickly smell grew as they surrounded the grove. Several moved along the pathways toward the clearing, effectively hemming Cheda and the others in. They had the look of the worst of Sharakai's malnourished, knobbly joints, stick-like limbs, the space between their ribs and hips a terrible sunken valley.
"Cheda?"
Sumer called nervously. She had every right to be nervous, for the Asuram were hungry beyond reckoning. But Cheda could spare no time to assuage Sumeya's fears. She focused her attention on the matriarch.
"Tell me your name," she repeated.
Silence greeted her words, but Cheda could feel the Aesir's intent growing.
"Rend, wreck, devour."
It was a compulsion, a directive that smothered all else. Her heart, her soul, even her memories. This was the taint Cheda must lift, or surely she and the others would die. As the Aesir lumbered forward, ever faster, Cheda called,
"Get back!"
and sprinted forward, placing herself in the matriarch's path. She raised her hands, spread them wide in a gesture of peace.
"Grandmother!"
was all she said. The Aesir slowed, then pulled up. Surprise and confusion warred on her corpulent features. The two of them were now close enough for the Aesir to grip Cheda's neck, for her chipped nails to pierce Cheda's flesh. The other Asuram had slowed their pace, but continued to trudge closer, their own murderous desires feeding their queens. The Adhikara branches rattled and shook, as if the very trees fed off the hatred pouring from these gathered souls. Cheda turned and saw Sumeya and Melis gripping the hilts of their shamshirs.
"No!"
she cried.
"Leave your swords sheathed, or we will feed the Adhikara."
Her words seemed to anger the matriarch. One meaty arm flew out, but Cheda was ready.
She snatched the Aesir's wrist with her left hand, twisted it before the Aesir's greatest strength could be brought to bear. She held her right hand up, palm open, revealing her tattoos and the wounds she had received from the Adhikara.
"Can you sense it?" Jade asked. "Can you sense the poison that burns within me?"
The Aesir's anger burned brightly, threatening to consume her, but Chaida's words had made her pause. For the time being, her curiosity was stronger than her desire to kill.
"Blood of my blood," Jade said.
The Aesir shook her head, her mouth working, tears forming in her jaundiced eyes. Chaida released the Aesir's wrist, then used her own thumbnail to gouge her right palm, soaring, the pain rising until she had broken the skin and blood began to flow. She had showed the wound to the Aesir.
"Blood of my blood."
She held it out, an offering, plain and simple. For the first time since rising from the earth, the Aesir seemed unsure of herself. Her eyes flitted between Chaida's unyielding stare and the bloody palm held before her. She reached for Chaida's hand, then took it in both of hers. Chaida had never seen a creature seem so fragile.
"The memories you feel are not your own," Chaida said softly.
She could feel Husamatine's influence, distant yet strong.
"They come from another, the King of Swords."
Around them, the Aesirim began to wail. It was soft at first, but it grew until it felt as though the desert itself was shaking from it. They were working themselves up to something. No, they were trying to convince their matriarch to return to them.
"Blood of my blood,"
Chaida said a third time, and spread her fingers wide, willing the Aesir to hear her words, to recognize the truth. At last, the Aesir's will seemed to crumble. Holding Chaida's hand tightly, she kissed Chaida's palm. Tears slipped along her blackened cheeks, two glistening rivers that met beneath the Aesir's chin and fell, pattering against the back of Chaida's hand. The Aesir blinked, then took in the clearing anew, as if she were confused to find herself there. The others howled. They beat the ground with their fists, their bodies twisted as if they were being tortured by the Confessor King. But they did not attack.
"Tell me your tale," Chaida said to the matriarch.
With this, the Aesir straightened, and the confusion faded, to be replaced with a steely resolve. She released Chaida's hand, then pressed her own nail into her right hand, as Chaida had done. Black blood welled, and she held it up before Chaida. Chaida didn't hesitate.
"Blood of my blood."
She took the Aesir's hand and kissed her blackened skin. She licked the blood from her own lips. It had a bitter, acetous, coppery taste, and with it came a rush of awareness. The Aesir became known to her, as did her sisters and brothers, as did the Adhikara that sheltered them. The knowledge expanded so quickly Chaida's head was thrown back. As the brilliance of the night's grand canvas filled Chaida's eyes with tears, and the veil separating her from the Aesir was torn, she was drawn down, 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 into a great, consuming darkness. Chapter 47. A young woman, Mavra, hardly more than a girl, hid behind a tall bush at the edge of an oasis. Spying a woman swimming naked in one of the oasis's many pools. How she wished she could slip into the water, take the woman in her arms. But the way her heart was pumping, she was sure she would die. The scene shifted, and the hand of the woman Mavra loved was being wrapped in a veil, then tied to a man, the two of them now married. They kissed, and with that one act, Marvra's heart was broken. 2 months later, Marvra was herself given to a man, a tent and sailmaker from their sister tribe to the south. By then she had already given up hope of ever being with her one true love. She had finally worked up the courage to speak with her, to confess everything, but the woman had shunned her, had laughed and sent her away, forbidding her return lest the gods take notice, and curse them both. Marvra's heart still bled at the very thought, so she buried her love and took her husband's hand. She gave birth to twins, sweet Trin and incontinent Amelie. How quickly they grew. The two of them were dancing on the sands of the Great Mother when they had their third, Evrim, who lit Marvra's world with every laugh. Her husband was soon lost to war, a skirmish with the Sharikani kings. But she was still young and took another, a dour man but kind enough and favoured by the Sheikh. With him she bore three more children, Layla and Gavind and Camilla, all of whom were babied by Trin. Trin's affection was a thing Marvra appreciated at first, but eventually came to regret. Shortly after Camilla was born, her husband died from an infection, a simple cut from an old knife. On his deathbed, he said through his tears, "Such a foolish thing to die over." And then he was gone, given back to the desert. Her third husband was a beautiful man, and attentive in his own way, but he drank too much. He gave her one boy and one girl, Mehmet and Natis, but took Evrim with him to an oasis to learn the ways of tribe Masal, who were meeting to celebrate the summer solstice. Both died in a drunken brawl. Forevermore the solstice brought Marvra sorrow, not joy. Her fourth husband wished to take her to Sharikai.
"And what has Sharikai ever given us but tears?" she asked.
But he was adamant. Opportunity lay in the city, he insisted. It was a place to live, to secure the lives of their children. And so they went. 5 more children came before her fourth husband died in an honor killing. A man from their tribe had come from the desert and slit his throat as he was being handed a loaf of bread at the edge of the bustling spice market. For months after, she was deathly afraid of the same thing happening to her or her children. She took no more husbands after that. She had many children already, and no great will to have more. Her family, however, grew. Like a rose unfolding before her very eyes, her children had children. Those who had not so long ago seemed so very young were now teaching children of their own what she had shared with them, what her own mother had shared with her. Her pride swelled beyond all reason. But pride or not, life in the city was hard. She thought many times of returning to the desert, but, as many in her tribe had warned her, roots will grow beneath the feet of the unmoving. Something always changed her mind, so she remained in Sharikai, finding work as a jeweler's apprentice. Her children and grandchildren helped provide for their growing household in the city's west end, and if some of them stole a bit along the trough, well, if it meant more milk, rice and bread for the babies, she was willing to overlook it. And then the desert shook. War arrived on Sharikai's doorstep. The tribes had gathered and were threatening to raise the city to the ground. All within the city feared for their lives, for the tribes' gathered might was terrible to behold. Word came that the kings had called all 13 tribes to attend the Montori At. Little was known, but the whispers spoke of a plan to save the city from the invaders. Not all could go. The sight of the gathering was not so great as that, but the jeweler bestowed a great honour upon Marvra. He asked her to join him.
"Might my family come?" she asked.
It was a bold request. The master was sure to deny her, but she would not go unless she could take some of her loved ones along. To her great surprise, the jeweler said they could all come. They stood upon the slopes of Toriat that